Professor Longhair. I like it, bro.
He can't hear you. He doesn't have his headphones on.
Oh, okay.
He was making fun of your hair.
Oh, I wasn't making fun. I was giving props. I said Professor Longhair. I love it.
Yeah, thanks.
We're all growing shit. I can't grow the hair, so that's why.
Beard looks great, though, man. It's a great
thanks, man. Yeah, if I could have grown the hair, I'd have the whole thing. I'd be like a wandering dervish, dude.
Hell yeah.
Well, at least you can grow a beard. I'm going bald without the opportunity of a beard.
Nice. Yeah, I just do the clean, you know. Yeah. I wish I had your bravery because I want to grow the Costanza.
Nothing says you can't do that. You can get on your dervish arc.
I know I could. I could be the dudes who have like the long hair.
Hell yeah.
But with the big.
I think you should try to look like a Jairus Banjani. Have you ever seen him?
I don't know what he looks like.
He's got like long stringy hair, huge balding spot right in the middle, and he's just doing it, man, in a South Asian way. I'm ready to start again if you guys are up for it.
Yeah, let's where should you think we should start? Just, you know, October 7th maybe?
I don't know. Wherever you want. If you want to
actually
ask questions,
I think I'd want to start with the Obama administration.
Oh.
Because this hostility towards Iran, and it seemed like during the Bush years, Iran was next on the hit list.
Yeah, after, the axis of evil.
After Iraq. There was this idea that Iran was developing a nuclear weapon and would nuke Israel. And Obama comes in and cuts a deal with Iran, which Trump rescinds. And then Biden comes in saying he's going to bring the deal back, and then he refuses to renew it. So,
well, why would the Iranians want to do another deal again when they knew it would be off the table again? But
it's what pushed them to sign what I think is like a 25-year agreement with China.
Oh, for oil.
For a lot of things.
Pistachios.
I mean, I don't know exactly what it is, but I know there's some things probably, I think like fishing rights are involved.
Belt and Road Initiative shit.
It's part of, you know, because that goes through Pakistan, I believe, and reaches Iran. There's a lot of things like that. It's part of China's pivot to Asia, which is, you know, we're the hegemonic power in Asia. This is our backyard, and that we encourage other Asian nations to look to us instead of the United States. I mean, I'm obviously vulgarizing here.
But it seems to have worked to the extent that any like multi-trillion dollar developmental program, like global developmental program, could work. It's kind of in crisis now, but
definitely.
But for like economic reasons, less than geopolitical reasons, because it feels like since October 7th, and you know, we have to obviously nod to that too as current events, it became more and more clear, also with the Russian-Ukrainian war, that there is like a separate proto-hegemonic bloc that's arising, of course, with China as its industrial center, Russia as its extractive center, and then with Iran and other Middle Eastern countries beginning to play an important role in it. So
if you remember something I said in the first half where I said that ascendant imperialisms always seem more progressive
than
the established imperialism.
Right.
And so I have China in mind that, you know, talking about China goes back to like the same with talking about Iran, that you got to remove a lot of baggage. And I think people fall into this, either they have to celebrate or they have to like sort of demonize instead of just being like, these are just capitalist states with bourgeoisies that follow their national and economic interests. And I think that, I know I'm sort of digressing, but it goes back to what the left does. I think that the left sometimes, especially the anti-imperialists or self-professed anti-imperialists, because like I said, we have to get to what that means, right? What was I about to say?
About geopolitics and—
Yes, China. Exactly. Yeah. Is that whereas, you know, how sometimes we might accuse some people of being economic determinists, I think there is an equivalent geopolitical determinism.
Absolutely. I see it all the time.
Exactly. Like we almost forget that there is a capitalist economy, capitalist world system, that now I don't want to necessarily say one determines the other, but why should we bend the sticks so far in either direction?
Right.
Right. And so, you know, the United States and China have as much in common as they do hostility. And so, you know, it's not like, let's not forget that even though there's geopolitical rivalries, we still live in a unified capitalist world where money talks and bullshit walks sometimes. And, but like I said, I don't want to necessarily bend it then again the other way and say the logic of, you know, the law of value dominates everything. Not at all. But we have to always sort of have that balance there.
But sticking with geopolitics for a second, I've heard speculation that the reason Trump pulls out of the deal and then the reason Biden stays out of the deal is because Israel has seen normalization with Iran as a threat to its own specialized status in the Middle East.
Sure, that makes sense.
I mean, but do you think that that's all that's behind it? Is there something more to the story?
I think that, it, you know, like I said, we have to always, you know, what we started with, we want to be careful between what makes sense and what is the case, right? But in terms of making, I don't see any reason why that wouldn't be an important one, in the same way that normalization with Israel threatened Iran's status.
Right.
You know what I mean?
Especially because we have to consider that Iran's main competitor in the region is not Israel per se. That's kind of like an outpost of American power, but it's Saudi Arabia, you know, another clerical regime.
Yeah, I mean, it's all of the above, you know. Look, before the revolution in the 70s, Iran had become the regional hegemon, militarily at least. Okay. The Shah's regime of the early 1970s was in a position of assertiveness that was unthinkable like 20 years prior. It was even intervening in other. So, for example, in Oman, when, and I'm only saying this to show how Iran's in a similar position now again that it was under the Shah's regime in some respects, at least in this respect, in terms of being a regional power that's not the dominant one, but is also a significant one. It's just that instead of being in the Americans' camp, they're hostile to it.
Right.
You know,
which was not predetermined, as you said in the main episode, right? Like there is a world. There is a world in which if the mullahs don't opportunistically use the hostage crisis to basically wipe out the left's claim to being the main anti-imperialist power, that you could have seen some sort of way modus operandi between the United States and Iran in a similar way that you see between the United States and Saudi Arabia.
Yeah, there could have been some kind of like detente or negotiation. And, you know, there's no reason to think that it was predetermined. They wanted to capitalize on the anti-American sentiment amongst the population, because there was. Mm-hmm. There was an anti-imperialist character. They used to refer to the Shah's regime as the coup regime, right? Because of the 53 coup, the second Shah, right? So, or the second Pahlavi Shah. The term Shah just means king for people who listen to going back in the monarchy. And so in the 70s, Iran was a very strong regional power. And when the Popular Front for the Liberation of Oman had risen up against Sultan Qaboos, I believe his name is, if I pronounce right. But anyways, the Sultan of Oman, the British-backed Sultan of Oman, there was a left-wing insurgency against the regime. Iran sent the military in to back up. And Iranians fought on both sides. Iranian communists went and fought on the side of the Popular Front, and Iranian Marines were there backing up the. Iran sent fighter jets to South Vietnam, for example, to bolster them against. So they were becoming a sort of power. It's important to note that under the Nixon-Kissinger, the sort of the Nixon doctrine was, in the same way that the Kennedy administration had been like, let's pick countries to industrialize and have reforms, they're like, let's pick countries that we will bolster and make them the strong military power in the region, so we don't have to intervene as much.
So
and
Iran so was,
it
was
went to Iran, and they basically said they sold Iran every non-nuclear weapon. And not only that, the Americans were the ones who initiated Iran's nuclear program. I have an advertisement somewhere. I've lost it. It was on a file somewhere. But if I, and I've been searching it forever, it's an advertisement by one of the energy companies in the United States about a nuclear power plant they wanted to build, I think in Plymouth or somewhere in Massachusetts. And it says, the Shah knows what's good for his people. You know, the Shah knows that nuclear energy is the way forward. The people of Plymouth will also see this. You know, it was very much like that when, you know, the Shah was ally number one. And so when the revolution happened, the U.S. doubled down on Israel, you know, as well as Saudi Arabia. But this is the thing, it's important to note, you know, the Shah wasn't, you know, I don't like this term puppet, right? Because it makes things a caricature. Saudi Arabia is not a puppet to the United States.
Right, yeah.
Right.
We've seen that explicitly in the last 5 years.
Yeah, no one's bossing the Saudi oil sheikhs around.
Right.
Right. But yet, they are an important component of U.S. imperialism in the Middle East. Right. And so the Shah in the early 70s was not simply just getting sort of pushed around. I mean, Iran at that point was buying American weapons on its own money. It wasn't taking U.S. military aid, which is what most countries do. You know, they take U.S. military aid and they spend that money buying American weapons. Right? Iran was using its own money. Because as long as the oil price was going up on the global scale, Iran could just pour money into all these development projects. The Shah said, we are going to be the Japan of West Asia. You know, that was the goal. We'll be the Japan of West Asia. We will compete with the Western powers because we will be the great civilization in 20 years.
And so similar to like even the blueprint of the Fordist era where each, it wasn't, the understanding of global political economy wasn't so much comparative advantage at that point, but like Sweden, Great Britain, France, Germany all had their own kind of homegrown auto industries. They all had their homegrown steel industries. They all had, were exploiting their homegrown energy resources. And so there was like this sort of Fordist geopolitical, political economic development program, which Iran was trying to do as well, right? Because some of the greatest
militancy they also formed, there was a domestic Iranian auto industry was formed during that time. It definitely was a kind of, you know, nationalist development. Khomeini could have cared less about all of that. His vision was one of generalized austerity. You know, when the hostage crisis was happening and, you know, the president at the time, who was later, you know, had to escape with his life, said, we're really suffering economically and there's a, you know, brain drain and a flight and all of this. He said, in the time of the prophet, the people ate one date a day and they survived.
Neoliberalism with Iranian characteristics, huh?
You know, it was just like sacrifice, martyrdom. So the war is really the creation of the Islamic Republic. And, you know, Saddam Hussein invaded in 19, he saw that there was disarray in the Iranian military and he decided that's the time to sort of invade and try to claim the kind of southern area that has an Arab ethnic population. After 3 years, Iran turned the tide and pushed out the Iraqis onto their side. This is to show another spectacle. This is why I'm getting this. This is the further spectacle from the hostage crisis. The United Nations put forward a ceasefire proposal, and every, like the powerful Arab nations like Saudi that had supported Iraq in the war, were willing to pay Iran reparations, right, if they would accept. And Khomeini rejected and continued the war for another 5 or 6 years. People say, like, what is this, crazy? He knew that so long as the war continues, he could maintain this unification of, you know, sacrifice, martyrdom. Like, it was better for the state for the war to continue, right? It wasn't better for the people. It wasn't better for people's lives.
No, there were millions of Iranians dead, right? And I guess that takes care of, like, your young, youthful, potentially radical population that might fight back against the regime, right? You send them to the trenches in Iraq.
And also, anytime there was a strike, you'd be like, oh, this is the imperialist sabotage.
Mm-hmm. Of our war effort, right?
Of our war efforts. So it crushed all it really was winter years, you know, during that period. Khomeini called the Iraqi invasion the blessing from God, you know, because he could put forward this vision of just a mobilized, you know, militaristic adventure, externalize the contradictions within the society.
Right.
But it's when the war ended in 1989, it was when the USS Vincennes shot down an Iranian passenger plane over the Persian Gulf, killing everybody.
Yeah, and H.W. Bush said he refused to apologize for America.
Yeah, exactly. And Reagan gave the commander of the Admiral the ship a medal.
Yeah.
It was seen, they always knew that the U.S. was, you know, different things on the side of the Iraqis, but that was sort of seen as like a direct intervention. And Khomeini called signing the ceasefire, I've drank from the poison chalice, because this is how painful it is for me to accept the end of the war. It's as if the happy ones are the martyrs. I'm the one who's here drinking from a poison chalice.
Wow.
So do you think the anti-Israel, anti-American rhetoric today from the regime serves the same function, because there's been uprisings against the Islamic Republic over the last 15 years? They've increased in intensity and frequency to some degree.
Now, I say this a bit in the article, and this is important, is that I do think that the ideology of the state as it exists today has worn thin, right, amongst the population. But we should never underestimate nationalism. Mm-hmm. and its ability to rejuvenate itself in a different kind of form. It won't take the same form of a kind of, you know, Guevara's green military fatigues against the U.S., but a kind of Iranian nationalism and patriotism, you know. I mean, you even hear people be like, I hate the regime, but at least they protected us against the Iraqis or something. Mm. You know what I mean? There's a kind of, you know, obviously not amongst the left or anything, right? And not amongst radicals, but amongst sort of middle class kind of Iranians. You know, remember, Iran is very stratified class-wise. But one thing I think will connect what I was saying to now is that since when the war ended, it was also Khomeini died shortly after. And just to kind of make long story short, Iran began post-war reconstruction. And so since then, it's really gone through a phase of just greater and greater neoliberal austerity, like many countries, mm-hmm. right? Iran's no exception to it. But it went from a kind of war economy to neoliberalism, mm-hmm. right, from that period on, of different varieties, liberal neoliberalism to kind of Ahmadinejad's populist neoliberalism. And so that, and why do I say this? Because that also shapes the uprisings that we see. Often here, it's always framed purely as a matter of, and this is something I think you started with, I don't want to downplay, you know, liberal freedoms and demands, right? But we always forget that there's also the devastation that neoliberal austerity brings to people, that also a lot of these uprisings have, like one of the biggest ones happened after they removed subsidies from like really important commodities such as like cooking flour and oil and things that working class people need. It went up like 200%. And that caused like one of the biggest, triggered one of the biggest uprisings of the past 15 years. And that, and so in Iran, one of the characters, like these things are mixed together, right? It's like austerity, environmental destruction, police brutality, like all these things have a sort of mix. And so you have a lot of liberals here, both Iranian and non-Iranian, who support like the Woman Life Freedom Movement, but they completely disregard any questions that, I mean, we know these are more than economic questions, but for lack of a better term, we'll say, you know, questions have to do with the economy, have to do with austerity, have to do with neoliberalism, have to do with mass unemployment, have to do non-payment of wages, have to do with all these sort of things that people, working class people everywhere are dealing with,
right?
Right. In the hinterlands of the US, in Iran, people see what's going on, but you get a lot of people, especially bourgeois Iranians here, who will even go out of their way of being like, it has nothing to do with that stuff. It's only about sort of like religious dress codes.
Right.
You know, which are important. Religious dress codes are important, but it's the breaking up the totality into these like little things, which makes it hard. And then people then here, they see these, you know, pro-Western charlatans, a lot of these Iranian exiles who come here and lovey-dovey with American politics, they're just charlatans.
And they get but, to...
want to say their names to give them any like...
They get nice like cynosures at think tanks and like defense initiatives and
live
high
on
the hog in the D.C. suburbs.
Someone like... exile, you know, the UN is giving some exile like a medal because
the MEK or whatever.
Yeah, for any of these people, even the ones that are sort of like accepted by the liberal bourgeoisie, let alone, you know, the former prince or whatever. But it's the fact that all these different issues are becoming harder and harder to disentangle from each other.
Right.
You know what I mean? That the latest one, when the latest one was triggered after Gina Amini was killed, I think a lot of times, because of the way that especially the diaspora in the United States interprets it, it gets kind of blurred and mixed up. But that's what I try to do is all these uprisings over the last 15 years, a lot of them have to do with austerity and neoliberalism as well as authoritarianism.
Right. And and as you rightfully point out, and you have a couple of great paragraphs about this, gendered oppression, right? You could view it simply as like a cultural issue or a civil liberties issue, you know, the donning of the garb and the religious police. But there is like a deep political economic essence to gendered oppression as it ties to capitalist accumulation, the whole realm of social reproduction of society, the double shift, you know, that Iranian women are more and more taking on, similar to women in the West. So to isolate it and say it's like merely gender does a great injustice to the totality of capitalist social relations.
Of it all.
Yeah,
definitely. And it's pointing, you know, a lot of times people, including people on the left, it's very shocking to me that people who call themselves Marxists even can't seem to fathom contradiction.
Yeah.
In a society.
Well, that's why you spent all those years on critical theory, and I think it's really helped. I want to ask an important question now, and this is going to tie into a lot of what we're talking about right now. You say in the piece that there is an authentic revolutionary movement and culture that now exists in Iran, and we've seen like the bubbling up of that as it comes to us in the Western media, which we know there's a certain valence on that. What is the nature of this revolutionary movement that you're talking about? And is it primarily a bourgeois democratic one, or is there some socialist content to it?
That's a good question. And that's sort of what I wanted to get across. Let me think of how to sort of put this. There's, just like there was in 79, there's a broad popular opposition. But there is a left in Iran, you know, and it's not like necessarily, you know, an easily identifiable one with flags, you know, because you can't have left-wing political parties in Iran.
Right.
There's workers organizations, but they're all tied to the state. You can't have independent workers organizations.
Political organizations. Like China.
Yeah.
Or the United States for that matter.
Yeah, but no, very much so. I wish I say how similar they are, because Iran does have a lot of institutionally democratic features, and they operate, right? And elections, when they have elections, they are more or less open elections. But now here is where the but is. The scope of choice gets so narrowed by the time it comes that you can have a free election, right? And be like, look, we have a free election. But really, it's not. And in the United States, it's similar, just operates different.
Absolutely.
There it gets vetted by... in Iran, it gets vetted by a kind of like a party apparatus, right?
Yeah.
Or the equivalent of one. Here, it's commercial interests will narrow it down. And then you're presented by Coke and Pepsi.
Yep.
And you get to have a choice. And, you know, Iran is a bourgeois state in a similar way.
And Great Britain works the same way within their system. Sure. And of course, too, you know, for all the hand wringing about the Russian elections, they seem pretty honest. You know, it's just that, as you said, in a similar way, in a different way from the United States or Iran, certain choices are left off the ballot. In Russia, it just happens to be like a government ministry that says these candidates are too tied to like Western NGOs and like, you know, liberal interests or whatever. And so every single state does this. So what you're saying is there is some content to Iranian democracy within the small stratum of choices that exist under the Islamic Republic.
To be
Republic.
A candidate, you have to get vetted, and they don't have to have any reason to sort of scratch you off. You know what I mean? And his name put off. So, and you have to fulfill a certain criteria, which you have to be ideologically on the good. That's very important. You know what I mean? You have to be like ideologically like in line, or, you know, you can't just be like, hey, I want to run for city council. You know what I mean?
You can't be Howie Hawkins and you can't be Jill Stein. You got to be Joe Biden or Donald Trump.
To the election time, you can run a free election.
Right.
You know, now the reason I brought up all that post-war neoliberalism is because this is what I just suggest to anyone who considers themselves someone on the left and is looking at Iran. And I had mentioned that, you know, sometimes we become geopolitical determinants. Yeah. I think when you look at an uprising, you have to ask two things before people jump to calling something an orange revolution.
Right.
You have to ask, does this have anything to do with the real material conditions in Iran? Because people act as if everything would be hunky-dory, just like what, like I said, with the 53 coup. Mm-hmm. Unless some CIA agent comes and says, hey, you want to risk your life to fight the guards in the streets?
Right.
You know what I mean? Obviously, a lot of these conditions that people are completely ignorant of have to do with the contradictions of capitalist crisis that are making themselves more and more manifest daily in Iran, as much as in the United States, as much as in, you know, a lot of countries in the world.
Yeah.
Pretty much every country in the world in their own way.
Yeah.
And Iran is no different in that sense. And I think to ignore that really is a kind of, it's really a problematic way to see the world. I know I've used the word orientalist enough. You can use anything. You could say it's a romantic way. It's a fetishized way. It's a reified way. But it doesn't see a society as a real society.
Right.
It sees it as a caricature of a society in which the ideological pronouncements of some demagogic politician overrides all historical materialist analysis. And the fact that people call themselves Marxists who take this approach is a cruel joke.
That dynamic has been one of the most frustrating things, I think, for me personally to see over the last several years. And I'm not sure why you even put the Marxist label on yourself if you don't take class seriously if you don't do what you did in this article. It's, I guess it's a cachet thing. I don't know.
Well, yeah, I mean, one thing I want to say is that even dress codes and religious laws have a class basis. When Gina Amini was murdered by the police. Now, I think what some people don't realize, especially when you had some campus types who were like, she didn't get killed by police. She died. You know, they tried to find all sorts of ways to say that the police didn't kill her. It's irrelevant, right? Because like George Floyd, people didn't need that to happen for them to be angry at police brutality.
Right. It was a symbol that sparked it off.
100%. She was the symbol that sparked it off. Nobody was all of a sudden in an uprising because they felt angry simply about hijab laws, right? It was the fact that the police can pick you up on any pretext. It could be bad hijab. It could be you're listening to your music too loud in your car. It could be, you know what I mean?
Yep.
There's like 100 reasons why those guidance patrols harass young people all the time. Now, she was young. She was a woman. She was Kurdish. She was from Sabiz, which is, people don't know, it's a kind of industrial sort of town that has a long history of radical labor organizing. That's why it was one of the big cities that jumped off. So she checks all the boxes, right? Ethnic minority, woman, young,
yeah,
right? From a working class town, right? So to people, particularly to ethnic minorities, to women, to young people, whoever has been sweated by a cop who stands there and says, hey, come here, you know, and find some arbitrary reason, right, to give you a hard time. And there's no shortage of kids who took in one in the side of the face by an angry cop they talk back to, right? Which is likely what happened to her. And that's what caused the jump off, right?
Yeah,
it was because it was sort of symbolic of that. Now, guidance patrols are not uniform everywhere. Now, I can't go to Iran, so I hear everything from, I have a lot of cousins and family live there. And you can have a great life in Iran. I also don't want to make people think that it's some kind of like Taliban-esque situation. Mm. Like North Tehran, it's like you're hanging in Beverly Hills or any other like, like if you've got money and you don't have to pay rent, you could have a great time. I know lots of people who go to Iran and they have a wonderful time and they party it up. If you're a working class person, right, and you got to pay rent in Tehran, which is one of the most expensive cities in the Middle East,
right?
Inflation is up. And those guidance patrols don't hang out in the really bougie neighborhoods of Northern Tehran.
They're not,
like, you know how they have like rich kids of Dubai? There's a rich kids of Tehran, right, too.
They're not busting like the Berlin style, like underground, like Tehran Berghain, for example, right?
What's that?
That's like a famous club in Berlin. I'm just imagining, yeah, I mean, like partying.
I've known people who've gone to Iran. They have underground parties. They have all sorts of stuff.
Yeah.
But when you go there, you'll see like women barely have their hijab hanging. Social mores are loose. Because those are the kids of people who have connections with the state. They're rich. They can pay off cops. You know what I mean?
Yeah, totally.
Those areas are known for being less, just like here, right? You know, police brutality, you go to the really rich, wealthy areas, kids get away with a lot more, right? And Iran's no different. Mm-hmm. And there's places, I know, because I have cousins who are totally unpolitical, you know what I mean? And they're like upper middle class kids partying. And you can have a sort of great time, right? And there's kids who live in those areas completely oblivious, right, to the problems that are happening in the country, you know?
I want to say, like, you mentioned the George Floyd uprising before, and like with the George Floyd uprising, the uprising we were talking about when this woman was killed ended with some motions of the state saying there might be some reforms. Has there been anything substantial since then?
No, but you have to understand that with all of these sort of laws now, there's always a kind of push and pull, right? There's times where things become a little bit more relaxed, and then there's times when the grip comes tightened, right? They did for a little bit say that they were kind of relaxed, from what I hear, but then in certain other areas, things get tightened. So it depends on where you live. It depends on where you are. If you are in one of the more prominent, rich, if you're in some rich shopping mall in Tehran, you might be like, oh, I came here. I didn't see any cops pulling people into their vans or any of that. You know what I mean? And that happens. Like tourists will go, oh my God, I didn't see any problems. Then you go working class area, you go to the Kurdish areas, you go to the Baluchi areas. It's like militarized zone, you know? So there's always
if you were
this kind of differences and contradictions.
If part of what you were trying to do with this article and in this episode was trying to make us understand like how not radically different, how in fact in many cases very the same the capitalist society in Iran is to a place like the United States, I think you've done a great job.
Thanks. I mean, that's always what I've sort of try to do is not to fall into those Orientalist trappings and to show that it actually shares a lot of the contradictions that any capitalist state, you know, particularly a capitalist state that isn't on the extreme periphery of the world system, but also isn't as in a core of the system, you know. But that's important to note, is that all this police brutality exists, all this repression exists, and there's also a world of ultra wealthy Iranians that are completely oblivious to any of this, you know?
Maybe we can end by going back to geopolitics, the geopolitical side, for a second.
Sure. One thing.
Okay.
I want to say that the issue of hijab, because I said it's not an issue, it's not about hijab in isolation. Mm-hmm. But to the state, the hijab is an ideological symbol, right? So it's not really about the piety if you're religious or wear it not or wear it not. You know, it kind of symbolizes the allegiance towards the state. You know, those guidance patrols, it's often women, because, you know, religious pious men aren't supposed to be arresting and searching women, right? So they have women officers, and it's about allegiance to the state. And the regime has always sort of used it in that way. Now, and it's almost a joke amongst a lot of people, or it is a joke amongst a lot of people, that whenever it comes close to election time, which they just had an election go, things get looser because they want to show a different face, you know? So you'll see a lot of pictures of rallies with women with their hair showing, holding pro-regime, like pictures of Qasem Soleimani. You know what I mean? It's to kind of project a different face. Newscasters who used to wear really dour clothing now all of a sudden have, you know,
like Fox News shit.
Because this last election that happened, Iran prides itself on having a high election turnout, which it often does, right? It's one of the sort of prides of the state to be like, it shows our legitimacy that we have a high election turnout, right? There was a campaign this time for people to boycott the elections, and it had the lowest election turnout since the revolution. So, you know, those things are kind of sort of steaming up. But if you want to talk about geopolitics, by the way, Qasem Soleimani, where the bombing happened at his funeral procession, that's my mother's side of the family. That's their hometown.
Oh, shit. Okay.
Wow.
So, you
know, it was a really horrifying attack. I think over 100 people died.
Yeah, a lot of people died, and it was really sad to see some people in the opposition, both in Iran and afterwards, being like, whatever, they're sort of just regime supporters. Because it was a, you know, it was a government rally that this guy.
Man, there were people saying that about the Crocus massacre in outside of Moscow recently too. I mean, people, the ability to dehumanize is like one of the, I think, most powerful things about geopolitics and nationalism.
Yeah, definitely. And it's like, I think one of my mom's cousins said it best, and she talked to a couple of them who were there, just kind of asking what was going on, and they sort of all said something similar. They said, we don't go to these things, really, because we're not of that kind of, you know, like, I think it's really funny. Like, people here who are sometimes are anti-imperialists expect everyone there is some kind of, like, militant with a headband chanting anti-American slogans. But you have to think that from a people's perspective, it's like going to some patriotic government rally. Like, would you? You know what I mean? Like, even if you cared about your country, it takes a lot to, like, get up and like go to some government rally.
Yeah, I didn't go to that.
Like the big general that got.
I didn't go out to Massapequa for that cops rally, the one that got shot in Rockaway. Yeah. Although I probably know some people who were there.
Yeah.
Yeah, it's something similar to that. And so they would go like, we weren't there, but it was Mother's Day in Iran. A lot of people go to the cemetery to visit their mother's graves. It's tradition. And also government rally. I'm not saying that people who aren't ideologically committed, because it would be ridiculous for me to say, and I say it in the article, that the government doesn't have a lot of supporters. You know what I mean? There's a big opposition, but there's also a big support. And there's people who are, you know, like any society, there's people who hate parts of the system, but they're not fully revolutionary. They might get radicalized. People change all the time, right? But a lot of government rallies, you know, they bus in poor people from the provinces. And it's a opportunity to get a, you know, you get a free meal, and it's a festive kind of thing. And, you know,
So speaking of Soleimani.
Yeah, I thought that would be a good segue. Since he was the big dog of the resistance.
I think this is a big question. But obviously what we understand about this axis of resistance against Israel is so colored by various kinds of misinformation. I guess the concept that the mainstream media makes it out to be is that the Houthis and Hezbollah and Hamas are kind of all on the same, and Assad are sort of on the same side. And Hamas recently put out a statement praising Iran for helping in what they're calling a world war over Gaza. And I mean, possibly hoping that further conflict breaks out with Iran, a major supporter of the anti-Zionist side of things. I mean, how do you see this situation? It always seems like it could flare up at any moment, especially in Israel's border with Lebanon. But yet it seems to be kept to this low level of bombing of various militant groups in various places that doesn't escalate any further than that, so far at least.
Yeah, I mean, it's actually interesting to mention that before we started, I just saw the news that Israel bombed the Iranian consulate in Damascus killed a couple generals there.
Damn. Oh, wow. In Damascus.
That's an escalation.
Yeah, I think it was Damascus, not Aleppo. I think it was Damascus. And it was not the embassy, but a consulate building they leveled. And, you know, Iran in the region is also, like, you know, kind of been a theme of what we're talking about. There's also a lot of, like, truth plus, like, muck you got to kind of sort of get through. Mm. And I had mentioned under the Shah the kind of geopolitical sort of power. And Iran has, maybe not to the way it was in the last years of the Shah because of the U.S.'s support, but it has reclaimed a kind of regional sort of hegemonic strength, you know. And I think in relation to these other sort of resistance forces in its camp, it isn't like, you know, people want to make it think that Iran is pulling strings, you know what I mean? But there is definitely a kind of coordination and unity and allyship, you know? So it's not like the mullahs are sitting there and being like, we're going to do this and we're going to do that. And they just jump whenever Iran says how high, you know what I mean? But there definitely is some kind of coordination. Now, it always has the potential to spiral out. And it's hard to know when, because so many things that have happened so far, I was like, this is going to be the one that's going to start the next inter-imperialist war.
Yeah.
You know, but it hasn't happened yet. One thing that I think people, particularly who see themselves as very pro-Iran because of its support, and this goes back to, you know, I might sound like a determinist to people, but I do believe this somewhat. Nation states will never abandon their national interest for some idealistic cause. Mm. You know, the Iranian regime is first and foremost concerned with its own self-preservation and with its own national interest, you know, and the idea that it would destroy all of that for Gaza, I think, is idealistic.
Yeah.
You know, but you never know.
No one's doing it. Yeah, that's for sure.
You see the hesitancy. I mean, I think that it came out in the paper recently that there have been continuous backdoor channels. I think it was it through Qatar? It was through one of the Emirates. Continuous backdoor channels.
People don't realize. Yeah. They're always happening. The U.S. always have secret meetings and backdoor channels, and they talk at the U.N. and things like that.
And there's an escalation ladder that both sides use. And up until this point, especially as Andy said, with the border of Lebanon and Hezbollah, it seems that Iran, and the United States have both been cautioning restraint among their proxies, and I include Israel in that, in order to not actually open up the doors to like a regional holocaust, because what a Iranian-American war would look like, as I understand it, would be thousands of missiles immediately just flying from Iran and blowing up oil refineries in Saudi Arabia, like the entire American fleet just sunk to the bottom of the sea within like 30 or 40 minutes of the beginning of this, and of course like the carpet bombing of large parts of Iran. It seems like our ruling class, as protective of their power as they are, they're also far too craven to risk it all, it seems, at this point, in a regional escalation into a war. But that said,
what's, you know, true today may not be true tomorrow.
Exactly, right? And like Iran as patrons of various proxies, and as the United States as patron of the main proxy or several proxies in the region, doesn't mean that those proxies don't go out and do something that can't be taken back. And
yeah, I mean, that's the problem with the term proxy, right? It's because it is like, I mean, we use it, it's ubiquitous, but it almost gives the feeling of like I said, like a puppet.
Right, right.
You know, when they're not, these are, and it's various degrees now, because they have different relationships to Iran. You know, Hezbollah's relationship to Iran is much more close. Their origins they're ideologically aligned, you know, and they have been Hezbollah was organized and helped developed by the Iranian Revolutionary Guard during the Israeli invasion. Mm-hmm. Before, there was another Shia group in southern Lebanon called Amal, and they were the main Shia group. And actually, they went to war with Palestinian militias. So it wasn't like everybody was always getting along. There's a lot of sectarian violence in the Lebanese Civil War, just like in Iraq. So Shia Lebanese and Palestinians, PLO positions had gone at it before. But later, I mean, they just got all, I mean, they still exist, but they're, I mean, Hezbollah became the main sort of one. And also there's the close ideological relation. But just so people don't get it twisted, I mean, southern Lebanon and Iran has, the communities have an old historical relation too. Right. You know what I mean? Southern Lebanon is highly Shia Muslim. And a lot of, you know, we talked about Bazari and clerical families. They not only have a lot of domestic connection, they also like have connection between these areas. So southern Iraq, southern Lebanon, Iran. Like, it's not uncommon to find people in southern Lebanon who have Iranian origins, or in Iraq, or the other way. You know what I mean?
As we close this out, I actually have a proposal for the two of you guys and the listeners at home for regional peace in the Middle East.
Just like John Stewart.
Yeah, like John Stewart, you know, the rally to retain sanity or whatever the fuck that was. My proposal is similar to how like Khomeini could be sort of like, you know, above and beyond the fray. We need like a bourgeois democratic figure that can do that in Iran. So I nominate, and maybe the United States and the CIA can back me up on that, a Zoroastrian, right? If we want to go towards like look back to traditions and talk about like monotheistic unity or whatever, what better opportunity than to get like some American puppet guy who's a Zoroastrian to go in there and be like, look, I'm not getting involved in this Shia shit, all this Sunni shit, all this Christian stuff. We're old school. We're going fire propitiation.
As long as his name is Zarathustra, I would support
that. That would be sick, yeah. Or Freddie Mercury.
Not a new idea.
Oh, really?
That is very popular among right-wing Iranian nationalists.
They want to go back, they want to return to
That was the whole thing under the Pahlavi regime. It was the, you know, the idea of the pre-Islamic history, the imperial history of the ancient Persian Empire,
the Sassanids and all that stuff.
It's the idea that, you know, there is a kind of anti-Semitism amongst like the hardcore right-wing monarchist sort of crowd.
Oh, Islam's too Jewish for them.
What's up?
Islam is too Jewish for them. Is that what you're saying?
Yeah, I mean, Arabs are Semites. It was the idea that this is a deep cut. Okay.
Yeah, please give it to us.
I mean, nationalism, a lot of nationalism, even in the non-European world, is influenced by European nationalist theorists. Mm-hmm. Right? And a lot of Iranian nationalists who are studying in Germany, right? Not only was the left influenced, the leftist student who went to Germany and became Marxist, there was also a lot of right-wing, proto-fascist, nationalist Iranians who became very influential in the Pahlavi period, who really took to German nationalisms. You know, so, and there was a lot of German sort of Orientalists developing these ideas of like Iran as the original homeland of the Aryans.
Oh,
and,
right. Yeah.
Because that's what Iran means, you know.
It's right in the name. In the yeah.
But the Aryans really, they originate from the Hindu Kush mountains and like the Indus Valley. Right. That area, you know, like the Vedic scriptures and this.
That's where the swastika is from.
Exactly. Exactly. So that idea, even though most of these people were actually not Zoroastrians, they come from Muslim families, but it was this fetishization of like, you know, just, you know, of like pre-Islamic.
Right. Like Himmler and the runes and shit. Yeah. Like yeah. That. Like real exactly. Indiana Jones in the Last Crusade. Mm-hmm.
Yeah. Not to say that like all pre-Islamic things are tied to fascism, but under that regime, like I said, you know, right-wing nationalism, there was this idea of glorifying the imperial sort of past.
Wow.
But, you know, communists also glorified aspects of the pre-Islamic history because some of it they could use for like secular traditions like our New Year's, Nowruz, it's the first day of spring, right? As like against the kind of tradition of sort of mourning and martyrdom that was influenced by religion.
My attempt to insert Ahura Mazda into this conversation, you know, it went okay, I think.
Your idea was not stupid enough.
It wasn't stupid
enough. I mean, give nationalists some credit. Population still in Europe. On, particularly in the southeast, you know, so
That's a good place to end it, but I do have one thing I need to ask.
Yeah,
and you feel free to go off. What is your thoughts on the Houthis?
I once made a post where I said anarchists celebrating the Houthis, now I've seen it all. So
anti-Zionism makes strange bedfellows, huh?
I mean, it does. I mean, I'm going to confess that although intellectually, you know, this is what my thesis is all about, now that I face myself in this genocidal war where I see a national liberation movement, it's forced me to have to confront some things because the typical left communist, let's just have a class war.
Yeah.
Seems to be, I mean, over 80% of Israeli society supports the war.
Yeah.
It's very hard to try to find a proletarian out.
Yeah.
With that said, the analysis still remains true that that is the only out, in the sense that even if there was a liberated Palestine that became a secular socialist state from the river to the sea, let's say, in this sort of world, unless it spilled beyond its borders and triggered revolutions in the surrounding countries, this liberated Palestine would be another peripheral country exploited by the regional superpowers and local regional powers, right? And I think the same thing goes for Iran. And I said this at the end of my article, that for the Iranian movement or uprising, or even if it goes a very far and deep level, for it to really take on a radical character, it would have to internationalize and spread beyond its borders. To remain within Iran, it would either become another sort of just bourgeois capitalist state, but most likely it would become another authoritarian one, because we forget that liberal democracy needs some preconditions. And if you're a oil producing nation in the Middle East, you require a heavy hand in order to make sure that your population doesn't disrupt those oil flows. Iran is the third largest oil producer in the world. It's what 80% of its economy is based on. So, you know, I think that so I'm sort of always trying to think this through since the war started, you know, because I've gone through so many different, you know, at first I was sort of horrified by some people's reactions. And then I've seen pretty much 500 October 7th happen every single day.
Right.
So now I'm sort of like trying to really reorient myself. And I think that while on the one hand, in the immediate, to just yell no war, but the class war into the dark might seem utopian and strange, that analysis still does stand in the sense that if there is to be a future in the region, if not the world, beyond dictatorships and nationalist wars and, you know, religious violence, it would have to be something that steps beyond the nation state as it is into something broader to be radicalized. And it would have to take place in the more capitalistically advanced nations, Turkey, Iran, Egypt. As well as, I still think the original thesis still stands, that there has to be a revolution in the imperialist metropoles. Mm-hmm. You know, the third worldist idea that like third world revolutions could exist on their own, this latest war should show us that's not the case. You know, absolutely. Even if the Palestinian resistance were to be successful, whatever that means, I'm just throwing it out there. You know, the imperialist powers would, you know, they can always find a way, you know, and this idea that the Islamic Republic would never want a detente with the West is also an illusion. Mm-hmm. You know, they were willing to sit at the table with the nuclear deal. And when they scuppered the nuclear deal, they turned to China because China was waiting there and said, we have a 25-year package waiting for you with much better deal than what the Americans are willing to give you. You saw that it was the Chinese that negotiated. Sorry, my cat's walling out. I don't know
what was that. Andy's was earlier, too.
The Chinese state negotiated the detente between Saudi Arabia and Iran without making any demands on either country. The United States makes demands. They go, you want aid? Do this, you know? But at least from what I saw, China didn't do that. So they were able to kind of fill that void that people see. So it's sort of hard to really find that negotiated balance where you do think that in the meantime, there needs to be something between what we have now in the world revolution, because
Houthi piracy. It sounds like you've gotten soft on Houthi piracy.
Well, going back to the Houthis, that was your question. Right.
I like where you digress to, though. I think that was very, very eloquent. And I think expressed a lot of our difficulties. I'm going to wave goodbye. I got to run to the city.
Peace, man.
Great to talk with you, man. This was great. Thank you so much.
Definitely. Take care.
All right. Thanks. See you soon, brother.
All right. Any last thoughts before we wrap up, Arya?
I don't know. Do you have any last questions? Oh, do you want me to finish my thought about the Houthis? I don't know.
Go for it.
I mean, you know, I'm happy to see anything disrupting the war effort, but I think people, and this isn't specifically about the Houthis, this has to do with sort of kind of anything, is, you know, any geopolitical battles, is to never forget that there's also interests involved on all sides here. You know, it's not purely altruistic. You know what I mean?
Well, what do you think the Houthis are after, if not just solidarity with the Palestinian people?
That's a good question. That's why I don't have anything sort of definitive about it. I mean, I think it could also have to do with domestic Yemeni politics as well. Mm-hmm. You know, I'm sort of stepping a little bit outside my bounds here, because I'm sure someone else could speak to the Yemen specifically much better than I can. But remember that the Houthis are also still technically in a civil war,
right,
within Yemen.
So it could be a similar, like, using anti-imperialism to consolidate popular support.
It could be, yeah. That's the first thought that comes into my mind, similar to the sort of hostage crisis. It seems like it's a blow, and it raises their prestige. It certainly did on the international level. Sure. We can't deny that, right? I mean, they went from being kind of this sort of obscure fringe religious group on the periphery of Arabia to being thrown in the center and getting sort of celebrated as this sort of anti-imperialist.
And really harming the Israeli economy. Like the ports in Israel are operating at a much lower capacity.
Yeah. Because unfortunately, I mean, you know, where, like, there are protests in Israel, but the pro-war protests are way bigger, you know?
Yeah, and the anti-war protests are not exactly, they're a little bit more anti-Netanyahu, bring the hostages home, more than they're...
Yeah. Now that could change.
It could.
And I think people have to accept the reality. Like I said before, there can't be a revolution, especially if we want a socialist revolution or one in a sort of anti-capitalist direction, that doesn't involve some revolutionary upheaval within the imperialist countries, whether that be Israel, the US, the UK, or even within Iran or any of those sort of ones. There has to be, right? Especially considering that the Israelis military has shown, the state has shown that it's willing to, there's no level to the violence it's willing to impose to maintain its rule. I have to say that, I had really, this is sort of, you know, a bit of a confessional here, but since we're speaking about anti-imperialism, I mean, this war happening, it's not that, like I said, I haven't fallen into nationalistic illusions. And I think that theoretically what I say about nationalism and a kind of myopic anti-imperialism really still stands. But I had kind of put a lot of, there's certain ideas I had kind of, let's say, just put into the back of my mind, you know, and had really felt, well, okay, this left communist position of class war against all imperialist wars is the right one. And I still take that view. But I think what I've sort of seen, which I always knew to be true and always was in the back of my mind, but I kind of played it down as a kind of identitarian thing. You know, and I had sort of put my Fanon and Said and post-colonial theory, sort of bracketed it, going back to a kind of more sort of pure sort of class position. But it's been a long time since I've seen so much of this. There is a deep ideological colonialist racism that exists amongst a lot of people in the West and in Israel. And I've seen it in a way that I had thought that has sort of shocked me and caused the kind of, like, in the same way that I had a crisis of faith during the Iraq War, which brought me to this critical position towards anti-imperialism. Mm. Lately, I've been shocked at the utter it's another kind of crisis of faith with regards to
working class internationalism
or the West. I mean, I hate to use the term the West because itself is an ideology. Mm-hmm. But yeah, even amongst people, like, you know, I always thought that Israel had a special status and that it had a carte blanche that no other nation had. But to see it in such a way and to really truly see that to a lot of people, even good liberal do-gooder types, some people's lives are worth more than others. Like, how is it that, you know, like, we now know more about what happened on October 7th, right? But I think a lot of people accepted that story, even things that are now been debunked so quickly. But for 5 to 6 months, we've been watching in real time this happen, and it gets less of a reaction by certain circles.
Yeah, I mean, the West, I think, is a good way to frame it, but also I think whiteness is a huge part of it too. I mean,
big time.
The people killed on October 7th are perceived as white, and the people killed on October 7th are seen as white, and Gazans are not. And regardless if that's true or not, there's what was true during the Iraq War is still true, is that non-white lives are just way less valuable.
Absolutely. And I think you put it the right way of seen as white, right? Because none of these have any real distinction. Right. I mean, there's Palestinians that have like red hair and green eyes, right. And there's black Palestinians. There's Israeli IDF soldiers that are black killing people, right? Mm-hmm. But I think you point to it of we racialize people in different ways. And in the American consciousness, the people who died on October 7th are white and the people in Gaza are not, regardless of what their actual skin color is. You know, it's who's seen. And I think for a lot of people, that's by extension, the whole Middle East. And then we can continue and go and say Africa, we can go in Asia. But I think for all Middle Eastern people, they see something of that in what's happening, but sure. On a, such an extreme level, you know?
All right, let's wrap it there. Thanks so much for talking, Arya. It's great talking
Thank
to you.
Thank you. It's been a pleasure. Thank you so much. I really appreciate it. We've been on here for, what, 3 hours?
That's yeah.
Good. I like it. You know, I hope you thought it was good and worthwhile, and I hope, you know, your listeners are into it.
Oh, for sure.
If we can guide people to the essay, and if they have any other questions, they can reach out to me. I'm on all the grams.
All right. Enjoy your 420 month. Have a good afternoon.
Thank you. You too, man. Okay. We'll talk soon. Take care. Bye. خود با یاد رها شویم سلاو ما اتحاد ما و حزب ما نظام کهن را زیر پا نهیم زمانه صاحبان زور و سرمایه به سر رسد این زمانه ستم به سر رسد عمر حاکمان بیکاره که دادیم دست خود به دست هم به پا به پا به سوی آزادی به سوی دوست